This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Cole Porter and Bobby Short to get us started this afternoon. This afternoon, we're going to talk about the life of playwright and director Moss Hart, one of the legends of Broadway's golden age. Our guest is biographer Jared Brown. Brown says of Hart, "If Hart had been a song, he would have been written by Cole Porter." Brown also says of Hart, "He seldom fell into a pattern. He strove continually to explore new territory." Hart is well known for his work with George Kaufman. Among the plays they wrote together, three are considered comic masterpieces: Once in a Lifetime, You Can't Take It With You, and The Man Who Came to Dinner. Hart is also well known for directing the original Broadway productions of My Fair Lady and Camelot. Our guest, Jared Brown, is the author, most recently, of a biography of Moss Hart, the title, Moss Hart, A Prince of the Theater. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jared Brown is Emeritus Professor of Theater at Illinois Wesleyan University. He is the author of five books, including a biography of Zero Mostel. His latest book, Moss Hart, A Prince of the Theater, published by Backstage Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jared Brown, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, and thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. It's nice to talk with you again. If Hart had been a song, he would have been written by Cole Porter. Would you expand on that?
Well, Moss Hart took a great deal of enthusiasm from the fact that he earned a lot of money and he spent a lot of money. He was always extremely well-dressed. He made a vow to himself once he began earning a good deal that he would never take the subway again in New York, which was where he lived for almost all his life. And so he took taxis everywhere. And he lived with a kind of devil-may-care attitude, I think, that Cole Porter shared in. And I think Cole Porter's songs reflect that feeling. So I think that's why I made that statement about if somebody else made the statement, I'm really not sure now, that if Moss Hart was a song, he would have been written by Cole Porter. Now, it is true that there was an underside to Moss Hart that even Cole Porter may not have been aware of. Moss Hart was a deeply depressed individual and consulted a psychiatrist for all of his adult life. But that was certainly not what revealed itself to most people. Very few people knew about this because he was expert at hiding it.
What inspired the title for this biography of Moss Hart?
Okay. Called Moss Hart, A Prince of the Theater, and this comes from a sentence I took from Kitty Carlisle's book. Kitty Carlisle was Moss Hart's wife. In her autobiography, she said that he was a prince, not of the blood, but of the theater. So Moss Hart was a prince of the theater.
Yeah. Tell us about their relationship, their romance, their marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had a wonderful marriage. From everything that I can tell, Alan J. Lerner said about them, they weren't an ideal couple, they were the ideal couple. Moss Hart didn't get married till he was 41, and Kitty Carlisle was 34. It was the first marriage for both of them. And they remained married until he died. They had two children that they were very proud of. And Kitty Carlisle today still refers to herself as Kitty Carlisle Hart. And she's extremely devoted to Moss Hart's memory to this day.
Yeah, she's going to celebrate her 96th birthday.
And she's still performing.
Yeah, this September 3rd. How is she?
She's fine. I saw her, the end of June in New York. And she's doing very well, obviously, if she can continue to perform. You know, that's certainly testimony. She's a wonderful person.
Yeah. Not too long ago, I heard her interviewed on National Public Radio, and she was absolutely delightful.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, yeah. And she talked about her life with Moss Hart, saying, "We lived in each other's pockets."
Mm-hmm. Yes, they were extraordinarily close. After they were married, when he worked, he liked to work at home because he said he didn't want to be too far from Kitty. Whenever he could be close to her, he was. He used to choose her clothes, for example. I think he also chose the jewelry that she would wear. And this was not imposing his will. This was not in any dictatorial sense. She enjoyed this. But they were in together's company almost all the time and loved it.
Yeah. When it came to assuming that style, that maybe that's also one of the reasons you might think of Cole Porter, a song by Cole Porter when you think of Moss Hart, is this the style that he had. And I just wanted to share this from your biography when you quote Kitty Carlisle Hart on describing his entering a restaurant. "He didn't just walk in, he made an entrance, his overcoat on his shoulders like a cloak. He looked like a great actor, and every head turned."
Yeah, and in the same way, he was very much in demand as a party guest. Not that he performed, but that he was so literate and was able to make such wonderful conversation. And in that sense, too, he made a kind of entrance, I think. It was said that when he went into a room, not just did he light up, but everybody lit up just for the fact that he was there. And I want to quickly say that he was not the sort of person who was loud. He didn't try to attract attention to himself in that way. He simply had this kind of magnetism that drew people to him. And so when he entered a restaurant, indeed, he did draw every eye.
Yeah. Did he have to work at that sense of style, or was it something that came naturally to him?
I don't think it came naturally to him. He was born into circumstances of extreme poverty in New York and worked very hard to get out of that. And I believe that he essentially devised a personality for himself that, in fact, ultimately became his personality, became a genuine personality. But he dressed extremely well. And as I mentioned to you, he always took cabs rather than going in the subway, etc. But I think that the style was a cultivated style rather than one that he was born with.
Was that also a way to keep the demons cloaked, you know, hide out a little bit?
It certainly could have been, yeah. Because, as I mentioned, he was in a depression for most of his adult life. And he didn't want anybody to know it. Now, Kitty Carlisle Hart, of course, did know it. But even his children really didn't. They said he never brought this home with him. He was always very congenial. He was a wonderful father. And so he did manage to cloak these demons, I suppose, in this kind of assumed personality. But I do think it ultimately became his genuine personality.
Yeah. It makes his accomplishments even more outstanding, doesn't it?
Well, it's amazing that somebody with that difficulty in life would be able to excel in comedy, I think, and also that he would be able to maintain his achievements throughout his adult life. He was certainly one of the outstanding playwrights on Broadway, ultimately became one of the outstanding directors on Broadway. So that he didn't allow these inner problems, these inner torments, to interfere with his professional life or, it seems, with his personal life.
Yeah. As you mentioned, his background was one of poverty. What would you like to say about his childhood? What was his childhood like?
Well, I would say, really, that it was quite unhappy. He made no bones of the fact that he didn't like his mother. He says so in the memoir that he wrote called Act One. He really wasn't very close to his father either, or to his brother, his only brother. Later they formed a close relationship when they were adults, but as children they weren't close. And I think Moss Hart's great drive when he was a child was to get out of these circumstances, to create a new life for himself. And eventually he came to realize that writing was probably the best way out for him. He knew he wanted to be in the theater in one capacity or another, and he tried acting. He was not completely unsuccessful at it, but he said he realized he would never be better than mediocre. And he said that's a deadly thing to say about an actor, so he tried other things. He directed a lot when he was very young. He directed for YMHAs and other Hebrew Jewish organizations. And that was really his first important experience, I think, in the theater. But as he directed plays and he worked with them and analyzed them, he came to think that maybe I can write these plays. And, of course, turned out to be a superior playwright.
One member of his family he was very close to as a boy was his Aunt Kate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she really introduced him to the theater. She lived with Mossart's parents for a time, and she was a person who was eccentric because she didn't have much money, not much at all, but she insisted on spending it for extravagances, principally going to the theater every week. And when she found out that Moss was interested, when he was a little boy, he was still only maybe 7 or 8 years old, she began taking him to the theater with her. And they did this for quite a while together. And then Aunt Kate had a falling out with Moss's parents, and they asked her forcibly, I would say, to leave the house. And so he didn't see her for a long time afterward, but he never forgot her. And always felt that she was probably the most important influence over his young life, Aunt Kate and his grandfather.
Yeah. At the age of 15, his father pulled him out of school to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do, and how did that affect him?
Well, it affected him, I think, by forever giving him a kind of complex. He didn't feel at all good about not having finished school, and he invented for a time the fact that he had gone to Columbia and said at some occasions that he had in fact gotten a master's degree at Columbia, I think to conceal the fact that he was really humiliated by the fact that he hadn't finished high school and certainly would have preferred to go on to college. Learning was always very important to Mossart. He was, as it turned out, a very erudite and learned person. But that was a matter, really, of self-education. And even, by the way, when he was in school, before his father pulled him out, he missed a lot of time, as I saw when I was going through his report cards, and they gave lists of his absences, which were very long. And it's difficult to know 50 years, 60 years, even 80 years later, why he missed so much school. I expect some of the times he went to the theater with Aunt Kate explained some of it. His brother Bernie was sick a lot with communicable diseases, and it might have been that Moss was quarantined and couldn't go to school. But I would imagine maybe his father kept him out of school to help somehow in his father's work.
Yeah. What did his father do?
His father was a cigar maker,
mm-hmm.
but cigar making didn't work very well for him. He opened a newsstand for a while, but his father was always on the edge of unemployment and frequently was unemployed.
Yeah. So when Mossart was pulled out of school by his dad to go to work to help put food on the table,
mm-hmm.
what did Mossart do? What kind of work did he get?
Well, he had a series of jobs, some of which interested him, but most of them didn't. He worked for a furrier for a while, and it was his job to go into the van, which stank, apparently, I guess because the hides had been in the van for a long period of time, and to take them out, and he despised that kind of work. And other jobs of that sort. He was a floor walker for a department store for a while, which he didn't like either. But what he really did like, eventually, was that he started... I guess I should change that, because he really didn't like it at the beginning but came to like it, is that he was hired to be a social director at a summer camp in upstate New York in the Catskills. And he proved to be very, very good at this and was invited back several times to a number of different camps. and became the leading social director in all the camps. And this is something considerable when you realize that Danny Kaye was a social director. A little later on, Phil Silvers was a social director. And this was also a time when, during the fall and the winter and the spring, Moss was directing plays in mostly in New York City for these Jewish organizations. So, as a social director, also by the way, one of his jobs was to put on a show every week, often a new show every week that he and his colleagues would write and perform. And so he got a lot of very good experience, I think, through these social camps. And he certainly got out of that work as soon as he possibly could when he became a successful playwright. But I do think that they were interesting formative experiences for him.
Yeah.
I remember that environment, by the way, because my father was a social director for a time at Camp Copake in New York. I was very young, so I can't tell you any of the specific things he did, but I do remember that they used to do a new play every week.
Mm. And also in the community theater that Hart worked in, they did ambitious productions.
That was always true of Hart as a director, that he didn't like to direct fluff, and so he chose serious plays frequently, or comic plays that he thought were specifically worthwhile. He sometimes, according to what he said in Act One, didn't use the actual names of the plays so that nobody would know what play he was producing and he wouldn't have to pay royalties. But in fact, I dug up some old programs of the plays that he directed in those early days, and they were listed under their own names. So I'm not sure if he was giving the full truth in his memoir.
Hmm. So now, how did Moss Hart go from a kid, then a young man sitting in the theater? He was social director, then he directed amateur productions of community theater. But how did he then go from that? What was his first important job? Would you say it was working for a man who called him Mouse?
Yeah, I suppose so. It was his first connection with the theater, professional theater. He was working for a man who was known as the King of the One Night Stands, who produced plays not on Broadway but around the country. And these were generally about as frivolous plays as you could get, but Moss became his office boy. And the person he was working for, Augustus Patou, tended not really to have any interest in the theater, except he used to study the railroad schedules to make sure that his companies would get from one city to another in order to make the performance. Moss was also a play reader for Patou, although it was a sort of informal thing, but Patou would give him plays to read and say, tell me if these are good plays or not. And after reading enough of them, Moss said to himself, you know, I really think I could do better than this. So he decided to write a play of his own based on these models that were being submitted to Patou. And he wrote a play that he later acknowledged was absolutely dreadful, called The Beloved Bandit. And it was, as he said, it was a kind of a ripoff, really, of these plays he brought home to read, and not much better than them. But it was produced in Chicago and in other cities. In fact, there was a time that it was thought that it would be brought to Broadway, although that didn't happen. But it was his first taste of professional theater. It was not, he says, a happy experience, because the play didn't make it to New York, and he felt that it was not a good play, and the production it received wasn't very good either. But it did encourage him, I guess, to continue writing plays, and then he made his great breakthrough when he was in his early 20s, early to mid-20s, with the play that you mentioned earlier called Once in a Lifetime, a play that... for which he got the original idea. It's a satire on Hollywood. If anybody has seen the movie Singin' in the Rain, and I imagine most people have seen that movie, the premise is the same. It's about actors who go to Hollywood and haven't really learned to talk clearly. And it is just one of the funniest plays ever written. When Moss took it to agents and producers, they all felt that here was a play that had some real potential, but it wasn't fully realized, and they suggested that he take on a partner. And the partner they all wanted him to work with was George S. Kaufman, who was an extremely well-established playwright at the time. But Kaufman almost always worked with collaborators. In all the years that Kaufman was writing for the theater, he only wrote one play by himself. All of the others were written with somebody else. And so Kaufman decided that he would work on the play, and Moss Hart says that he did improve it tremendously. But Kaufman said when the play was finally done in New York and was a tremendous success, he made a curtain speech, and he said, "I want everybody to know that this play is 80% Moss Hart." There was a feeling at the time on the part of critics that George S. Kaufman must have been the person responsible for this extremely funny play, and Moss Hart must have functioned as not much more than an office boy, but Kaufman wanted everybody to know that that wasn't true.
Yeah. Makes Kaufman sound like a very good guy.
Well, he was certainly a tremendously intriguing person. He was devastatingly witty. He was an extremely hard worker. He was, in many ways, a terrific collaborator, not only for Moss Hart, but for the other people who worked with him. Mm-hmm. But he and Hart worked together for 10 years and became very close friends. He was also Moss Hart's mentor, I would say, and his life example. Kaufman was a good deal older. He was, I think, 41 when he met Hart. Hart was 24 at the time. But they had a kind of father-son relationship in a way, but they were also extremely good friends. Kaufman was a kind of a very reserved person, and so he and Moss Hart never had the kinds of discussions in depth that they might have had when you consider how close they were otherwise. Because Kaufman just didn't have that kind of temperament that he wanted to get involved in somebody else's life. As I said, Moss Hart had these problems with depression, but Kaufman never saw it. And with somebody that he worked with so closely, you'd think there must have been signs, but Kaufman just said, "Well, he seems fine to me."
Yeah. Well, from The Beloved Bandit, when Hart was all of 19, to 5 years later, and Once in a Lifetime, and this meeting that gets set up between himself and Kaufman, you know, what a moment that must have been in Moss Hart's life.
Tremendous moment, because Kaufman was already his ideal before he met him. Kaufman was a tremendously accomplished person, he not just as a playwright, but as a director as well, and he was everything that Moss Hart wanted to be. He was witty, he was an intellectual, he was tremendously accomplished. So, yeah, I think it was probably the decisive moment in Moss Hart's life. Later, in a way, I think it became very important for Hart to break that relationship, not the friendship, but the working relationship, because many people perceived that Hart really couldn't excel as a playwright without Kaufman. And I wouldn't be surprised if Hart himself had that fear that without Kaufman he might not succeed. Now, nobody knows what his sessions were like with his psychoanalyst, but I think it's a pretty good guess that this formed the basis of some of the conversation in those lengthy psychoanalytic sessions, that Hart worried about should he break with George S. Kaufman or shouldn't he. And finally, he decided it was absolutely necessary for him. He did break with Kaufman, and he went on to a tremendous career by himself and with other collaborators.
But they remained contemporaries, or they remained cordial?
Oh, definitely, yeah. They were close friends. They remained close friends.
Yeah.
And they had houses together in Pennsylvania, very close to one another, about a mile away, and used to visit practically every day.
Yeah. I don't know whether I'm reading too much into this now, but there is an anecdote in the book from Kitty Carlisle Hart. This is before she was married to Moss Hart. She's his fiancée. And Hart, in this anecdote, stands up to his mentor on her behalf.
Mm-hmm.
He comes to her aid, in a sense. He comes to her side when she suffers a scolding from George Kaufman during a game of cards.
Yeah, it was a very public scolding. It was a game of cards, and there were a number of other people there. And for some reason that she says she can't imagine why she did this, she started talking a kind of baby talk. And Kaufman said, we don't talk baby talk here. And this was about as stern as George S. Kaufman could get. And she says there was a long moment of silence, and she started to cry. And Moss Hart must have been in a difficult position. This was his fiancée on the one hand, and it was his friend and partner on the other hand. But finally he spoke up, and he said, in this house, she can do anything she wants. And I think that that was certainly significant to her, and I'm sure to him as well.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, biographer Jared Brown. His latest book is Moss Hart, A Prince of the Theater. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. They are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Back when Hart was beginning to test himself through his writing, and he had the beloved bandit under his belt, he was still having a tough go of it, a hard go of it. And then, as you suggest, a rejection letter came to him that led him in a different direction, into comedy.
Mm-hmm.
What did Hart think of comedy at that time?
Well, when he thought of his own personality and his own outlook on life, comedy did not come to mind. The playwright he admired most was Eugene O'Neill, who certainly was not associated with comedy. He did favor George Bernard Shaw's plays, which were comedies, of course, but they were also social documents. Probably social documents before they were comedies. And Moss Hart always felt when he was a young man that he would write serious plays, that is, non-comic plays. But he submitted a play to an agent, and although the play wasn't accepted, when the agent's letter came back to him, the agent said something about your best writing seems to be in the comic scenes, and maybe you should concentrate on comedy. This was, I think, a little difficult for Moss Hart at first to accept, because it meant changing his whole point of view about the kind of playwright he would become. But it seems that the criticism was right on target, because most of Hart's plays had succeeded, not all of them, but most of them were certainly comic, and he obviously had a great flair for comedy.
Yeah. And you say that he came to eventually to a greater, deeper appreciation of comedy, arguing that comedy and satire could speak as eloquently as the most searing.
Yeah, absolutely. When he did commit himself to comedy, he became not only expert in it as a writer, but he came to appreciate comedy much more. And I think he came probably to realize this early notion that comedy was not as worthwhile as so-called serious drama was probably an immature judgment.
What was the moment like for him when he knew Once in a Lifetime was a success?
Oh, well, this was his first real taste of success, and it absolutely changed his life overnight. He went home from New York City, having seen Once in a Lifetime and spent the evening with a friend of his. Then he went home to the Bronx and told his parents, we're leaving this place, this shoddy apartment that they had, shabby apartment, I should say. And he said, we're going to take a taxi back to Manhattan, and we're going to live in a hotel. And that's what they did. The money just intoxicated Moss Hart tremendously.
Yeah.
And it also allowed him to become a buyer of almost anything that he saw in a store. He was a phenomenal buyer of virtually everything, especially clothes, but virtually everything. He said, whenever I go into the department store, I feel all these objects just tingling as if they just can't wait for me to buy them. And he normally did buy them. Later, much later, he said that I've made more than $5 million with my writing, and I've spent every cent of it, and I don't regret a moment of it.
Yeah. A good dinner and a taxi ride. Let's talk with a listener now. Listener in Broadlands, line one, hi.
Oh, hi. I'm enjoying the show and enjoying hearing about Moss Hart. I'd be interested in hearing more about the play You Can't Take It With You, which I, that was one of the first plays that I really identified with, I guess. And I think it was interesting to hear you mention Eugene O'Neill and that he was interested in doing serious plays because I think if you look at You Can't Take It With You and The Man Who Came to Dinner as well, there's a portrait of America that's unsurpassed. I think a lot of what's good about America can be seen in the family situation in You Can't Take It With You, in that they're a eccentric, madcap, creative, exuberant entity there that is a portrait of a family situation that I identified with as a child, and then again as an adult. I was lucky enough to see the production, I think in the 80s in New York, with Jason Robards and Colleen Dewhurst, and it was a revelation in many ways. But the content of his plays, you haven't talked too much about that, and I think that they are substantial in many ways along those lines. And I'm calling on the cell phone in the car, so I'm going to hang up and listen to your comments, but I'm enjoying the show very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'll be glad to respond. I think I don't really have a great deal to add to what you said because I agree with so much of it. I do think that this portrayal of this eccentric family in You Can't Take It With You and the creation of such wonderful characters who are just vastly entertaining from the moment the curtain goes up to the moment it comes down is really unsurpassed. And I think that's almost measurable, given the fact that this play has been revived again and again and again in New York City. But it's also been done in virtually every high school and every college and every professional theater in the country. The last I recall, I think there were 7 different television productions of You Can't Take It With You. And it's been said, and I think it's been said reasonably, that almost everybody who writes a situation comedy about a family is trying to emulate You Can't Take It With You. And that play, by the way, won the Pulitzer Prize, which is sort of extraordinary because even at the time it was a very controversial selection. Some people called it an escapist comedy. But I think your comments are correct, that it was much more than an escapist comedy. It did catch the flavor of not only the times, but I think of the American people. Now, there is one other side to this. In The Man Who Came to Dinner, which is almost an equally accomplished play, I think, that play was written, as was You Can't Take It With You, during the Depression, but you would never know it from seeing The Man Who Came to Dinner or reading The Man Who Came to Dinner. Everybody in the play seems to be wealthy. Everybody in the play seems to be able to travel here and there and have unlimited funds at their disposal. And, of course, that was not what was happening in the country. So in one sense, I do think you could say that these plays are escapist. But on the other hand, as you pointed out, You Can't Take It With You is a play that really does, I think, identify the fabric of America.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Other telephone calls are invited for our guest, Jared Brown, biographer. His latest biography is of Moss Hart. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, while he had these successes with comedy, he continued to write dramatic pieces throughout his career, and that was pretty chancy. He was taking some chances there, and that cost him financially as well. And thinking back to the poverty of his childhood, I wonder, why did he take those chances?
Well, this is one thing that I admired most about Moss Hart, that he continued to take risks as an artist. I think there are been a lot of people in, I guess, in every walk of life, but certainly in the theater, who have identified a niche for themselves, and they know that they can do very well, and so they repeat themselves over and over and over again. And I don't think Hart did that. As you pointed out, he did attempt to write serious drama, often, I think, with real success, although not perceived maybe that way by the public. For instance, late in his life, he wrote a play called The Climate of Eden, which I thought was quite a fine play, and it's certainly not a comic play. It's very serious, and it's very ambiguous, which is unlike most of his work. And it certainly did not succeed with the critics. It had the shortest run of any of Moss Hart's plays in New York. I think it ran for 20 performances. Yeah. But it is, I still feel, a fine play. And it's just a shame that people, when they heard the name Moss Hart, expected a witty and brittle play. And then when they saw The Climate of Eden, they had a hard time accepting that it wasn't the kind of play they expected from him. He also, by the way, wrote the screenplays for A Star is Born, the Judy Garland version of A Star is Born, and for Gentleman's Agreement. And some pretty serious matter in both of those, especially, I guess, Gentleman's Agreement, but I think also in Star is Born. So he was certainly capable of writing serious drama, but I do think that his greatest talent was for writing comedy.
Yeah. What did The Climate of Eden, what kind of story did that tell? What did it involve?
I'm always very poor at giving synopses of plays, but I'll do my best here. It involves a minister who is certainly an unconventional minister. I don't think that he was referred to as a minister of any specific religion, but he has a kind of almost tyrannical relationship with his family. He's a loving husband and father, but he is not unwilling to discipline his wife and children by hitting them occasionally. He certainly seems unconventional in his views of, let me take an example here. A young man falls in love with the minister's daughter, and the minister said, well, I don't mind if the two of you live together. I don't mind if you have a sexual relationship, but I don't want you to get married. And I would think that that would be generally regarded as unconventional for a minister.
And also for the year 1952, that would have been pretty out there.
Yeah, absolutely. but it also involves, the story of the play involves the young man who lives with the daughter. He has lost his wife either because, and I mentioned before this play is ambiguous, either because she killed herself or he killed her or she died in some other way that is never revealed fully. And there are a great many mysteries in this play that are purposely not solved. I think I believe he was trying to create this sort of ambiguous picture. For instance, why is the minister so almost abusive with his family at times, and yet they certainly love him, and he certainly loves them? That's not explained. It's just it happens. There's a duality in every individual. I think, and this play portrays the duality without trying to explain it.
Before we run out of time, we have to talk about My Fair Lady and Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
My Fair Lady, I loved reading this portion of the book and hearing on the page Julie Andrews talk about Moss Hart.
Yeah, this was when Julie Andrews was 19 years old, and she was doing her second play in America. She had been in a musical called The Boyfriend and was very successful when she was 18. The Boyfriend was a kind of satire of typical musicals, and Julie Andrews was wonderful in it. I saw it, in fact. She clearly showed herself to have a wonderful singing voice and was a very satisfactory actress in the production. And on that basis, she was cast in My Fair Lady, playing Eliza Doolittle. Most people will know that My Fair Lady was adapted from Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. And Eliza Doolittle is an enormously challenging role for any actress of any age. And here was Julie Andrews, who was 19 years old, playing the role. And she certainly could meet the vocal demands of the role. She sang it beautifully. But in early rehearsals, she just couldn't play it very well. And she was really intimidated by the fact that she was playing with actors like Rex Harrison and Stanley Holloway, who were old hands in the theater, greatly experienced. And she felt pretty keenly that she was not doing the job, and so did others. People went to Moss Hart, the director, and said, you know, we've really got to find another actress because she's just not going to be able to play this role. So what happened was that Moss Hart decided that they needed to spend a couple of days just in one another's company, no other actors around. So they went into the theater, and they spent 2 days taking a break, of course, for meals and going home to sleep and coming back a second day. And he just worked her extremely hard on every line, every attitude, every moment, every intention. And she said it was the most difficult thing she's ever gone through, but she said the most valuable thing she'd ever gone through. And she said he absolutely saved her career because she would not have been able to play that role without that kind of intense two-day experience that she had with Moss Hart. And when the other actors came back 2 days later, they said to him, how did you do this? She's a totally different person, she seems. She's able to actually master this role after all, a role that we never thought she could play. So Julie Andrews has always said that he was directorially the most important influence on her.
Yeah, a kind of a Pygmalion story happening right there.
Absolutely.
For real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got to wrap up pretty quickly here now, and maybe you'd tell us a story, a Camelot story.
Mm-hmm.
Another marvelous success, but it took a toll on him.
Absolute toll, not only on him, but on his collaborators as well. Camelot seemed to have been almost a cursed show. The lyricist and writer of the book, Alan J. Lerner, got extremely ill during the production. The composer, Frederick Lowe, got extremely ill. The costume designer, Adrian, died. There were a number of other deaths that were associated with this production, and Moss Hart had a heart attack. It was a real crucible, this play. They desperately wanted to get it right, and they couldn't seem to get it right. They knew it had to be, when they were working on the production, they knew it needed to be shorter, because the production was running 4 hours, and that was simply too long. And they kept cutting and cutting and cutting, and no matter how much they cut, it seemed to be growing longer. And finally, so many people were getting sick or, in fact, dying that it seemed almost hopeless. Well, the show did open in New York because, although it wasn't in very good shape when it came in to New York, Julie Andrews and Richard Burton, who were the two leading players, were so well known and so admired, and everybody felt that a play directed by Moss Hart and written by Lerner and Lowe after the success of My Fair Lady would have to be successful. Well, it wasn't very successful in its early run, which many people tend to forget. But then they were offered the opportunity to present some of the numbers from the play, the musical numbers from the play, on the Ed Sullivan Show. And although this was supposed to be a tribute to Lerner and Lowe, who could present songs from any of their musicals, they decided to do all the songs from Camelot. And people who watched those songs being done by Julie Andrews and Richard Burton and Richard Goulet just fell in love with them. And they flocked to the theater, and this coincided with the fact that Moss Hart was able to get well enough after his heart attack to come back and work on the production, revise it considerably, shorten it, and sharpen it. And then it became a great success. Most people remember the great success. They forget how difficult the process was to get there.
Right. And not long after, Moss Hart died.
Right.
Of a heart attack.
Yes, he had a subsequent heart attack. All his heart attacks were preceded by a toothache. And when he had a terrific toothache, this was after Camelot had opened, and Moss and Kitty moved to California because their doctor told them that he should get into a different climate and a different circumstance. When he had a toothache one morning, she was very afraid that this might be the precursor of another heart attack, and in fact it was. She was going to drive him to the dentist, or it may have been to the doctor. But before she could back the car out of the driveway, he had collapsed and died.
Mm.
And he was only, I think he was 57 at the time.
Yeah. And Kitty Carlisle Hart and their children, Chris and Kathy Hart, were left alone, although we know, of course, now that Kitty Carlisle Hart is still out there and the children are successful.
Yes, they're both doing very well. Yeah, yeah. Chris is a producer and director, directs a lot of his father's plays, by the way. And Kathy is a physician in New York.
Yeah. What a story. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, I thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Jared Brown has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Moss Hart, A Prince of the Theater, the book is published by Backstage Books.